election results. Diego Morales makes history while Todd Young cruises to a second term. Plus, a controversial Supreme Court case on a Marion County nursing home and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 11th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Republican Diego Morales made history. He is the first Hispanic statewide elected official in Indiana history as he won the race for Secretary of State.
Morales' campaign had been dogged by controversy, but he was defiant in victory as he cruised to a comfortable win.
The truth always prevails. Let me say that again. The truth always prevails. Always.
Democrat Destiny Wells' concession speech was a call to continue to fight against efforts to tear down our democracy.
Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Independents, all of us, we must fight together to strengthen and reinforce our electoral system.
Democrats haven't won the Secretary of State's office since 1990.
Are Democrats irrelevant in statewide races? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. Caitlin Lang, State House reporter for the Indianapolis Star. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, if Democrats couldn't win this seat, can they win any statewide?
It's been the question of the week. Can Democrats win statewide anymore? And I think I tried to, like, actually when Caitlin and I talked on Wednesday, I said, let me ask you something. Let's take Indiana out of it. Take Republicans out of it even. If I said, you know, gee, when are Illinois voters going to elect a Republican statewide? I'd sound like an out of touch, it kind of like a homer, you know, I just kind of like sound like an idiot. Right now, I never went to the Republican Party to be in a position where they're like, well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, actually running competitive and engaging the other party in statewide elections, that is how you start deteriorating. But if you look nationally, just zoom out again, kind of forget about Indiana, states kind of line up in one of three buckets right now. You're either holding the hard line for Republicans, you're holding the hard line for Democrats, or you're one of these like five states that's kind of like rotates in and out of being the swing state that decides majorities in Congress or the White House. And we're just not there. And that's just like in Illinois, where Democrats have had this generational control. I was in Illinois when all that flipped in 2002. I worked in Illinois politics, and it was like, at the time, I was like, and it was not a secret, like, this isn't flipping back, right? So if you want a job, you may want to go back to Indiana, Mike. And that's exactly what I did, and here I am. But it's just like, that's just where we're at. That's just where we're at as a party right now. This is a deeply red state. We proved that. The parts of the state that are deeply blue, we still proved are deeply blue. Marion County, Lake County to a lesser degree, even though 5 points is the razor's edge in that district for Republicans.
I like many, was predicting a red wave all over the country on Tuesday. That clearly did not materialize. Is that in a way almost worse for Democrats here? Because at least if there had been a red wave everywhere, you could just go, well, there was nothing we can do. But here, you just can't get traction on a statewide level.
Well, you can't get traction for those downstate, down ballot offices. That's right, because you can't ever raise enough money. You know, and the Republicans ought to be ashamed of themselves, not only nominating this clearly unqualified bozo, who's our newly elected Secretary of State, but then supporting him, even after the allegations of groping and perhaps voter fraud. I just wonder whether the Hendricks County prosecutor, since that's all you guys have talked about since Trump lost the election in 2020, is voter fraud, he's going to look into whether the allegations raised by the Indianapolis Star are correct, and if so, indict him.
It's not just been the down ballot races. You're not competitive in the U.S. Senate.
Have a strong candidate in U.S. Senate. I'll grant you that because you had an incumbent. But
incumbency, I think Todd Young is an extremely strong candidate. Yeah.
Well, he's also not a crazy like Braun. He's not. And he didn't vote not to certify the election, or he didn't, you know, he certified the election. So there are differences between the two of them, so that he doesn't raise the level of animus that Braun.
Like, even gubernatorial races.
But the gubernatorial race may be different this time around.
Maybe, but we've won by 15 or 20 in three of the last four, and the one that we didn't, the pencil was lost, that was our fault.
You proved that at this moment you can elect anybody, and that's who he is. anybody, and he's terrible, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself as a party for even giving him the nomination.
Does 2024, I mean, 2024 could be a very interesting election year here in Indiana.
Especially if Trump's on the ballot again.
The national ballot playing a huge role. There's a question about whether Mike Braun will run for U.S. Senate again for re-election or whether he'll jump over to the governor's race, which would then create an open Senate race. You'd have an open governor's race. It could be a really wide open field, especially in the primary on the Republican side. Is that more the test of what Democrats can do in this state, or is it just going to be slowly trying to build yourself back into relevancy?
We could always talk about the next race, but right. We have races that just happened, yeah. And there was no question. It was absolutely definitive. And even, you know, Diego Morales's margins weren't even impacted by all those. You know, he was still at 80% of the vote, you know.
Where the
he lost about five. It looked
like
he lost about five. Three to five points from the rest of the
vote. That's not much. So, I mean, maybe they can swing 2024, but I don't. Unless an amazing candidate steps out, I don't
see
it yet.
Well, it starts today.
Well,
right?
Or so a Russian comes in again. And
well, it didn't work here this time.
Well, I'll say this, though. Okay, so Ann brought up the point of money, especially when it's not at the very top of the ticket, but even this year at the top of the ticket.
Well, I talked to
someone Tuesday night at the Republican Party event who said, you know, as we saw that Diego was clearly going to win, who said, listen, you got outside of in the Indianapolis area, nobody knew about all
that's
of the stuff that was going on with that campaign. And that's a problem of money. The Democrats don't have the money to get their right. message out. Is that really, at this point, what it's going to take to at least determine whether or not they're relevant, is an influx of cash?
I think so, but it's challenging because I was talking to one expert this week, and it's a very much a chicken and the egg problem of what came first, because the more Democrats lose here, the less I think national groups want to invest here, which again makes it harder to win here. So it's just this endless sort of cycle here, unless you have a self-funder or I guess just a really attractive top of the ballot candidate. But I agree that, you know, not everyone's reading every news article about Diego Morales. So, you know, without having the money to pay for ads, it's really challenging to win.
And I suppose one area where the question I just asked, is money the difference? I mean, where Democrats won that wasn't deep, deep blue, which is the Marion County prosecutor's race, in the first district. There was a ton of national money that poured into that race, and they were able to survive in a year when Republicans dominated
a lot of other stuff. Democrats here have to start putting money in to defend places they've always had. For 100 years they've always had. That's a problem, too. You can't expand the map if you're defending what you've held forever.
That's your problem, too, in Hamilton County, because that's going to change. And it's going to change in the next election cycle or the one after that. And the other part of that is they put a fortune in against Ryan Mears. And it made, a 3-point difference, maybe?
Comparatively to what a normal prosecutor's race. But I'll also say, as much as Republicans clearly dominated here in Indiana, the Senate, Republicans picked up one seat, and it looks like it'll be the status quo in the House.
No, I think that they're going to pick up a seat in the House.
You think they're going to flip one of those?
I think the Fleming seat is going to flip. They found 1,800 votes they forgot to count.
I mean,
details.
Counting votes. Really, is that what we're about?
Election fraud. It's fraud.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, when will Indiana Democrats next win a statewide seat? Within 5 years, 5 to 10 years, or more than 10 years? Last week we asked you who will win Indiana's Secretary of State race, and nope, not even close. 19% thought Republican Diego Morales, to 79% for the Democrat Destiny Wells, 2% for Libertarian Jeff Moore. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Republican U.S. Senator Todd Young won a decisive re-election victory this week as he heads back to Washington for another 6 years. As he thanked people on election night, Young talked about earning Hoosiers' trust over his next term.
I'm going to work tirelessly over the next 6 years to ensure that I live up to your high expectations, to ensure that we yield the sort of accomplishments that you deserve. Not rhetoric, but results.
Young said he's ready to fight the president's agenda wherever necessary, but also stressed that he'll work across party lines when he can. Young's Democratic opponent, Tom McDermott, voiced a similar note of bipartisanship in defeat.
I want you all to know that it's imperative that we get behind Senator Young and support him and try to move America forward, because we got a lot of problems in this country.
Republicans have held this seat for more than a decade. And Eleni, barring something unexpected, Young will serve in the Senate for at least 12 years now, by the time his next term is done. Is it time to, for him and for us to start thinking about what is Todd Young's legacy?
I think he's already doing that. I mean, I think the fact that he didn't go with the rest of the crazies in his caucus to not certify Joe Biden as president was one step in that direction. I think the second big step in that direction is his effort with the Biden administration to put that chip manufacturing facility up in Lafayette area. I think that's a very good legacy and a very important legacy for a manufacturing state like we are. And the fact that he would work with Joe Biden, it seems to me, shows that he's thinking, I think, of that, not of the next reelection campaign.
His last ad in this election cycle was promoting the CHIPS Act, mm-hmm. Which his Senate partner from Indiana, Mike Braun, voted against and has criticized heavily. He talked about bipartisanship in his election night speech, which is the opportunity to just, like, declare victory and, you know, trumpet whichever party you serve in. But he said, yes, I'm going to oppose the Biden-Harris agenda wherever necessary, but I want to work with the other side whenever I can to strengthen this mm-hmm. country. Is, in a deep red state, which is currently what we're in, it seems like, is that an interesting path to take?
I think it's a very Hoosier path to take if you look at the former occupants of that office, whether it's Birch Bayh or Richard Lugar. And, you know, over the years, I think that has been a hallmark of popular kind of statesman-level U.S. senators from Indiana. I and kind of had my answer, which is he's already really started that. And part of the reason he was, you know, rewarded with never a doubt about reelection is because he has tried to be very thoughtful in the middle. When Trump was in office, he wasn't always with Trump, and when he was, and he explained why, and everybody said, yeah, okay, that, you know, that makes sense. He didn't get, you know, destroyed for it. He was thoughtful and open about where he is, whether it's working with the Biden administration on the CHIPS Act or, you know, when he's not with the Republican caucus, he explains why, and people appreciate that, I think.
When I talked to Todd Young before the election, I asked him this question about things he's taken that have angered some Republicans. He voted for the gun bill in the U.S., the bipartisan gun bill in the U.S. Senate, the CHIPS Act, which has drawn criticism from Republicans. He said he was very gratified by the fact that he wasn't challenged in the primary this year. Is that telling that even in a state that seems fairly conservative at this point, that they're at least supporting this guy who's saying, hey, I'm going to work with whoever I can work with whenever I can?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I think most other candidates we've seen who aren't all the way with Trump, they were primaried, whereas the opposite, you know, if they were too much with Trump, they were hit from the left. But Young had neither of those. And I just think it kind of shows a path forward for Republicans of, okay, here's how you can succeed and make both sides happy in this, you know, environment where Trump is still very much a factor.
I said barring something unexpected. Which in my mind was, what if he wants to run for something else? But at this point, feels like Todd Young is right where he wants to be.
Yeah, I don't sense that he wants a different route at this point. I mean, obviously, he's still finishing up his first term, so talking legacy is a little crazy. But, you know, you do got to give him a little...
In this environment, there's 6 years at a time.
Yeah.
That's like an eternity.
Yeah. We got to give him some credit. He has figured out how to spread that needle, you know? If he could teach the rest of the nation how to thread that needle, you know, it would be a different political world.
Yeah. All right. A majority of candidates who campaigned on so-called parental rights won seats on suburban school boards north of Indianapolis this week. School boards in Indiana are made up of nonpartisan officials, but campaigns in Hamilton County featured national political talking points and endorsements from high-profile politicians. In Hamilton Southeastern, a slate of anti-critical race theory candidates supported by conservative groups won 4 seats on that district's board, and 3 candidates with similar platforms won seats on the Westfield Washington School Board. The Carmel Clay Board race proved less successful for conservative candidates. Only 1 of 3 candidates on a conservative slate won a seat.
Caitlin, proponents of this sort of ideology obviously failed at the State House last session. Not suggesting that it won't come back, but is their focus now going to be a little more on just the local school board level?
I think it was a really smart focus because obviously in these local communities, there's been so much attention on these issues. Parents seem to really, really care about these issues. But I don't think it's going away at the State House level. This has been an issue pretty much every year in terms of how much rights should parents have in the schools, you know, the idea of opt-in, opt-out provisions, those sort of things. So we'll very much see those still at the State House. But I think this strategy of focusing on more localized government might help them get more of a leg up in the State House as well moving forward. You know, these state lawmakers are going to look at the results of these local school board races and see what happened there. But I think we'll see more focus on more local school board races in the future, but it's definitely going to still matter in the State House in 2023.
To the local school board level, they definitely had success, particularly in suburban areas, but not everywhere, right?
No. Obviously, there were a couple of these candidates up in the Fort Wayne area that a state lawmaker even endorsed using the kitty litter myth. They both lost. I do find it interesting. We're talking about local decisions, local school boards, and this big fight that's kind of happening. But in the end, we mentioned money. The money did not come locally. The money came from outside trying to kind of push the theme here.
And is that partly why, if you're one of these, if you're someone who believes in this sort of thing, going to the local school board level makes maybe the most sense, because you don't have to spend a ton of money comparatively to make a huge difference, right?
Yeah, the problem is, though, that, you know, in particularly in the suburban areas, one of their biggest draws has always been their public school system. And people want to move there because of the public school system. If they get into the kitty litter dynamic and the critical race theory and all those other crazy ideas they have, they could impact that school system, those school systems, in a very negative way, and house prices in the bargain. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see what they can do without irritating all the other parents in the area.
Part of what's been driving, not part of what's driving, but part of the debate around a lot of these issues at the State House has been, should we make school board races partisan? There's a lot of pushback on both sides of the aisle to that idea at this point, but do these sorts of successes from the same sort of people make partisan school board races more or less likely? Is it, well, we're winning, so we don't need to take this step, or is it, we still want to sort of solidify our chances?
Yeah, I don't. That's just a step the legislature hasn't been willing to take, and I don't think they should take. It failed, the first minute
get,
of
yeah,
the last
didn't
session.
Get,
right?
Didn't even get a vote in the committee.
Didn't get a vote, it got a hearing, and that was the end of it. We'll see. I mean, what I think is probably more likely is if some of these school boards get really, really out of, really extreme and start missing, that the legislatures, that school boards, the power school boards have will be diminished.
Down.
I bet they start coming in and whittling it back.
Interesting. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week on a case centered around a nursing home owned by a Marion County agency. A ruling in favor of the agency could strip millions of Medicaid beneficiaries of the right to sue states. But WFYI's Farah Yousri reports some legal experts say the court seems unlikely to undo decades of legal precedent.
Attorney Paul Garcia in California said he took a cautious sigh of relief after hearing the oral arguments.
The real question before the court was, are they going to issue a normal decision, or are they going to drop another bomb like the Dobbs decision? My takeaway was the court seems reluctant to drop another bomb.
One of the most telling moments was when Chief Justice John Roberts suggested legal precedent seemed to be clear enough.
It imposed a pretty high bar in terms of the evidence that was required. Why isn't that sufficient?
The justices, however, appeared receptive to a narrower argument that nursing home residents in government facilities may not have the same right to sue states in federal court. A decision on the case may come as late as next June.
Nikki Kelly, I started with legal experts think the court won't overturn decades of legal precedent. I feel like we've heard that before somewhere. So can we really trust the court as currently constituted to adhere to precedent on anything?
Obviously, they've shown that precedent alone is no longer going to guide their decisions. So no, you can't say that. And I do think there's probably an argument to be made for, you know, narrowing any ruling. But you know, you do have to consider the worst case scenario in a case like this, and you have to talk about things like, you know, if someone is, you know, abused or mistreated, and they're a private pay person in the Marion County nursing home, but someone on Medicaid is right. abused or mistreated in the same nursing home? How come one has more legal rights than the other? And I think that's the decision they're going to have to deal with.
Aside from the sort of policy impact that this case could have, it's gotten very messy here at the local level because, I mean, you have local politicians who are decrying the fact that this lawsuit was brought. I think there was a resolution locally to withdraw the case, but the agency is not. So, I mean, this is a mess all around, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a weird one, too, because you have, for once, you have a Democrat-led agency in Marion County teaming up with Todd Rokita, a Republican. That's just
then
weird.
You know you're on the wrong side.
That doesn't usually happen. So, you know, you have those dynamics. And I know a lot of people have compared this case to it's kind of like the Roe versus or the Dobbs v. Jackson of, you know, this type of policy. That's how impactful it's going to be. So, yeah, it's a very contentious one.
On a policy level, first of all, predicting the Supreme Court at this point seems like it's always been a bit of a fool's game, but it really seems like a bad idea now. But do you almost have to start preparing for what you do in case this, I mean, you're asking Congress to do something now, which seems like a bad idea, right?
Well, that's what Tom Fisher, that was his perspective, that Congress needs to clarify this and help states understand what they're taking on when the feds design these programs, when the feds fund these programs, when the feds have to grant permission to administer the programs, and then you're getting sued, you know, in the process of that. So does Congress need to clarify that and what the rules are and what the threshold is? I think that is what Tom Fisher, the state solicitor general, was arguing. But it seems like it could be pretty far-reaching. And I agree with Nikki that the Supreme Court has, clearly, this new Supreme Court is not just going to let precedent stand on its own necessarily, but it has. I mean, we've had a couple high-profile cases where they've overturned, obviously, abortion and one other, but they have come in and, you know, for example, document retention by former presidents. You know, they have come in and not just gone along with whatever, you know, you think Donald Trump might want or what, you know, Republicans might want, or that it's precedents overturned. We're just going to create chaos, too.
Yeah, it seems, again, predicting the Supreme Court has never been a good idea, but it seems increasingly hard to predict because on the one hand, they do something like Dobbs where they just threw out, for the first time, repealed a right that they had granted. But at the same time, they do things that would seem to dumbfound you, which is, you know, the case Mike brought up or the example Mike brought up. So is it increasingly like, I guess we'll just wait for maybe next June to find out again if things have been thrown into chaos?
The Trump documents thing is a narrow focus, and it would be very hard to defend if they went the other way, and it doesn't have the kind of impact.
I think you'd argue all these are hard to defend.
Well, I think this has the potential, though, of depriving hundreds of thousands of people of a legal right. And yeah, okay, they need guidance. Well, the guidance is that if these people are in your care, you can't abuse them, you have to treat them. You know, that's pretty standard, okay? They're accepting the money for this. Mm-hmm. And they ought to be providing...
I'm with you on the policy.
Okay, they ought to provide, the care. And taking the right to sue away from them, it seems to me, is something that I'm afraid this Supreme Court could do. And I think it's the wrong decision.
Is it increasingly showing us, Nikki, that there's a lot of sort of rights or policies that we've been relying on the Supreme Court solely to provide for us for quite a long time now?
Well, except in this case, we're not relying on the court to provide it. There is an actual law. Yeah. It's called Section 1983. It's a post-Civil War law. It's been on the books for that long. They're just trying to interpret its scope. So, right. I mean, there is a law at the base of the argument.
Maybe we should just issue guns to everybody in the nursing homes and say they can shoot people, and then, you know, they can defend that. Who knows?
Sounds like a
That's the only thing they really, that's the only right they really want to protect is somebody's right to carry a gun.
All right. Finally, a township trustee in Delaware County, Indiana, nearly won re-election this year despite not filing to run. That's because of an error in the clerk's office accidentally put her on the ballot. She was removed after early voters alerted the clerk's office to the mistake, but she still received 32 votes, meaning the unopposed winner of that trustee race only got 95% of the total vote. Mike O'Brien, is this a previously unimaginable power of incumbency?
If she would have stayed on, she would have won.
She genuinely said, like, the reason she didn't want to run is she was, I think she's 73 years old and said, I just don't want to do this again. But it was this close. Right. Because it's easy to take her off the ballot, but if she
would have resigned.
Yeah, she would have had to resign, then it's a whole process. I mean, is this incumbency to the extreme?
Oh, you know, and these things are done by people, okay? And people make mistakes. And it doesn't mean that there's this massive conspiracy out there. It just means that people are people, and that's obviously what happened here.
I am surprised that there's not been more of an, there's not a, doesn't appear to be any narrative, despite, you know, voting problems in Arizona with the machine, that, where people are questioning the outcome.
No,
people
in a cycle,
that's
when,
that's
when,
that's
when
so why, many those, because
in a cycle,
someone
in
is
a cycle
not president.
So many
yeah.
of those people were running, too.
Yeah.
Right.
We've
Michigan.
Seen concessions.
And they're running in, like,
in
Republican
Michigan.
Seats where they ought to be winning, and they're losing them, but there's really no...
Yeah, not to this point.
Suggestion that it's not.
Well, we'll see
wait,
when the results
wait,
are all counted
wait.
In Arizona and Nevada.
Yeah, exactly.
That remains true. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Caitlin Lang of the Indy Star, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS Video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.